there's shipping, there's energy, there's resource extraction.
The Arctic Council gives Six Nations observer status from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 16th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, record-breaking snow, cold, and breakup over much of the state.
Next Monday is the 20th. I'm imagining that the ice is probably going to hold out that long. So we figure we're going to have a record breaker.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The Arctic Council, the Association of the World's Polar Countries, has agreed to grant observer status to six non-Arctic nations. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, some people fear the countries are trying to secure long-term commercial interests.
The Arctic Council will now allow China, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, India, and Italy observer status. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski attended the biannual Arctic Council ministerial this week in Kiruna, Sweden. She says the new observer countries will not vote on policies and agreements, but they will have a voice in negotiations.
It allows you to be in the discussions, to help formulate some of the papers that are then reviewed. So it is more than just sitting in a room and having a credential pass around your neck.
Voting on new partnerships like the one on oil spill prevention agreed to this week remains in the hands of the eight polar countries. And alongside those are six permanent participants, groups representing Arctic natives. Charlie Ebinger directs the Energy Security Initiative at the left-leaning Brookings Institution. He says people are justifiably concerned that these new countries are using observer status as a stepping stone.
Obviously, those countries want observer status because they believe they have long-term commercial interests with new maritime routes. You know, the Chinese have been looking for mineral deposits in Greenland, both the rare earths and uranium.
And it's not just mining the countries are interested in. James Collins is a former ambassador to Russia. He says the Arctic is still an emerging market, and more resources will become available as climate change opens the ocean.
There's shipping, there's energy, there's resource extraction. And exactly which companies are going to be active in pursuing those is probably only beginning to be defined.
Canada takes over the chair of the Arctic Council this week, and the United States follows suit. So for the next 4 years, the chair will be in North American control. Luke Coffey is a fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and he says it's a good sign of U.S. involvement that both Secretary of State John Kerry and his predecessor Hillary Clinton attended the Arctic Council meetings. They are the first two secretaries of state to do so. But it should not stop there. He says the U.S. should start to consider a diplomatic post to handle Arctic negotiations.
For the U.S. to show that they are serious about the Arctic, it needs to be at a very senior level, which might very well mean even a more senior level than ambassador.
Coffey suggests a deputy secretary of state for the Arctic. Both Senator Murkowski and Senator Mark Begich have called for an Arctic ambassador. Senator Murkowski says the administration does not support the position. And as for the expanding council, Senator Murkowski says the observer issue is resolved after it dominated much of this week's gathering. She says no countries will be added to the list of observer states, nor will the European Union, which is seeking the designation. Still, there are major global players located far from the north that will now have a hand in Arctic policy.
There is a lot of discussion about, well, what do you think their motives are? I look at it and say, I have to assume that their motives are they see that the Arctic is filled with opportunity and promise, and things are happening up there, and they want to be involved. They want to know what's going on. They want to be on the inside.
She says a country's observer status is up for review every 4 years, though she acknowledges no country has lost it since the Arctic Council formed in 1996. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
ConocoPhillips says it's reviewing spending in Alaska a month after the legislature passed Governor Sean Parnell's oil tax reform. The tax cut is worth billions of dollars to oil companies in Alaska. ConocoPhillips executives talked about the state's new tax regime during their annual meeting and an analyst's presentation earlier this week. Alaska Dispatch reporter Pat Forgey tuned into those discussions and joins me now. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Ellen.
So what was the biggest takeaway from the ConocoPhillips meeting and the presentation this week?
It's going to be difficult for Alaska to get new spending up here. Conoco's got a lot of things they want to spend money on elsewhere in the world, and we're going to be competing with them for those projects, that investment.
Was this a foreseen outcome of this tax reform? I mean, I think the assumption all along was if they got the tax lowered, then they would invest more in Alaska. Is that what was that? What was on your mind?
That was what the proponents definitely said, but I'm not sure if it was just a hope or whether they had anything behind that, but this meeting certainly indicates it's going to be tough.
So where else did they mention investing that would be more profitable?
They've been looking at a lot of oil shale plays, the Permian, Bakken, and Eagle Ford shales, Canadian oil sands, Malaysia, Gulf of Mexico, they're especially excited in. Lots of places they've got to spend money at.
What did the executive say about paying out shareholder dividends?
That's a very important part of what that company is now. They pay a very high dividend, over 4%, and they promised that they would keep that up, and their growth is geared towards doing that, towards making sure they've got a lot of cash available to pay dividends.
Did the Alaska oil tax cut come up during the meeting?
It didn't come up at all during the annual meeting, and they never actually brought it up during the analyst meeting. Eventually, one of the analysts asked about it, and they definitely sounded like they'd like to invest more in Alaska, but whether they'll be able to, whether it'll meet their investment hurdles, it's hard to say.
Pat Forgey is a Juneau-based reporter for Alaska Dispatch. A federal agency says it will consider a petition seeking to list a population of harbor seals living in a freshwater Alaska lake as a threatened or endangered species. The National Marine Fisheries Service says it has accepted a Center for Biological Diversity petition to list seals that live in Iliamna Lake, 200 miles southwest of Anchorage. The agency has a November 19th deadline to perform a status review of the seals, estimated to number 250 to 350 adults. The agency can propose a listing or reject it. A listing would present a potential environmental hurdle for the Pebble Mine. The proposed open pit copper and gold mine would require a 140-mile road to Cook Inlet. About 50 miles would pass along the lake shore where the seals hunt for salmon. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage farmers markets get ready for a chilly opener this weekend.
In ours, you really feel like you're in Spinard. Why would that be? As an example, we have a tarot card and palm reader.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Start a meaningful career with a bachelor's degree in elementary or special education from home or on campus from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
A state report shows the value of minerals produced in Alaska more than tripled between 2001 and 2011. Mining industry wages have also surged as employers seek skilled workers. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Mining wages are a small part of private sector wages in Alaska, 2% in 2011, but total wages for mining have more than doubled since 2002. That's according to economist Molly Abrahamson, the author of an article on the Alaska mining industry in the May edition of Economic Trends, a publication of the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Annual wage paid by the mining industry has increased 22% from 2002 to 2011. In perspective, the same rate for all private sector jobs in Alaska, their wages have only grown 8% in that same time period. So in a 10-year interval, you see almost double the wage growth.
While state records show thousands of active mom-and-pop mining claims, most of the jobs in production are at seven major mines. Those are Red Dog, Fort Knox, Nixon Fork, Usabelli, Pogo, Kensington, and Greens Creek. Abrahamson says the growth in wages is due in part to the shortage of skilled workers.
If firms were able to find less costly workers elsewhere, and if they were able to bring them in from outside, they wouldn't have to. You wouldn't see quite as much wage increase as you have. We have been seeing.
The latest figures available from 2011 showed 300 or more openings for electricians, heavy and tractor trailer drivers, and construction laborers, and strong growth anticipated in jobs for miners, extraction workers, and mining and geological engineers. Abrahamson says the growth is driven by increased production and by higher commodity prices. The price of zinc doubled in 2006, and gold and silver prices surged in 2011. The price of gold has dropped by 20% since its high last year. However, Abrahamson says mining companies have increased spending for exploration. She says although it takes large projects years to reach production, she foresees continued increases.
So you expect growth to occur in a stair-step method, you know, in kind of fits and starts. And that's exactly what we see in the job growth, is that you'll have a 1 year where a firm will start up a new operation and you'll see 250 job growth over in 1 year, and then it'll kind of have slower growth.
Abrahamson says that same scenario has played out several times since 2005 in different locations across the state. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Tanana River ice is on track for a record late breakup at Nenana. Later than normal breakups are expected at many interior river communities due to this year's cold spring, but there's special significance for the Tanana at Nenana, where over $318,000 jackpot is at stake in the annual Nenana Ice Classic guessing game. Classic manager Sherry Fornes says most of the 261,000 breakup time guesses entered by ticket buyers this year have gone by.
I don't know that for a fact, but I would say probably the majority of them.
Fornes says we are nearing the latest time that Tanana ice has gone out at Nenana in nearly 100 years of record keeping.
In 1964, it was May 20th at 11:41 a.m. So next Monday is the 20th. I'm imagining that the ice is probably going to hold out that long because of the way it is right now, unless we get a real heat wave. So we figure we're going to have a record breaker.
Fornes, who's been with the Ice Classic for 17 years, says the Tanana River ice is slowly rotting, and she observed open water holes both up and downstream of town yesterday. The National Weather Service is predicting a, quote, extremely unusual late season snowfall for the South Central Alaska area on Friday through Saturday morning, meteorologist Dave Snyder.
By this time tomorrow, the front should be working through South Central Alaska. That means the greater amount of cold air will be meeting up with moisture, and we would expect periods of rain to start mixing over with heavy, wet snow.
Snyder says snow fell today at the 1,000-foot level in Anchorage's hillside area. The snow is predicted to change back to rain through the evening, but the surge of cold air that is expected could result in more of the white stuff. Snyder says this storm is unusual because of the length of this year's snow season. Anchorage's first snow fell on September 29th of 2012, only a short bit short of an early snow record set in 1947.
If we get snow on Friday and it accumulates, it has to be at least a tenth of an inch or more. That'll make it 231 days, making that the longest snow season duration on record. The other part of that is the amount of snow in the second half of May, that there are only two instances in the record books where measurable snowfall was recorded in Anchorage at the official climate station during the second half of May. And that occurred on May 17, 1989, and May 22, 1964, and both of those storms deposited 2/10 of an inch of snowfall.
The current prediction could mean slush on roads and hazardous driving conditions Friday evening and Saturday. It may not feel like spring yet in Anchorage, but that's not stopping the farmers' markets from opening. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
There are two small piles of snow left in the Spinard parking lot across from Chilkoot Charlie's, and Mark Butler is determined to make sure they're gone by Saturday.
So I'm walking over to our snow pile, the biggest one, and I'm hoping to knock it all down, or at least a big chunk of it, so that we can spread it out and the sun this week will make the snow go away. We're going to try it and see if I can get under the icy pile here.
That's because Saturday is opening day for the Spinard Farmers Market, which Butler helps organize. The Spinard Market is one of six markets throughout the city and the only nonprofit organized entirely by volunteers. Some opened earlier this spring and others will start up in the coming weeks. Butler says each market is different, and that's intentional.
The idea in a community market is not that we're in competition with each other, but rather that people can come to the market closest to them, if they choose, and they can see their neighbors, and they can talk about their kids, and who's doing what, and what's happening, and what events are happening, and so forth. And we think that's very neighborhood building, very positive for the community.
Butler describes what's special about the Spinard Market.
In ours, you really feel like you're in Spinard. Why would that be? As an example, we have a tarot card and palm reader. So we're probably the only market in Alaska that has one. And we are a bike-friendly market. We have a lot of people who come by bike. Families show up by bike. We have bike racks and so forth. We have a mobile mending booth.
Wait, what did he say? A mobile mending booth?
She mends stuff while you wait.
So you can get a button sewn on your shirt while you shop for locally grown produce and get your palm read. Butler says one improvement to the market this year is a new sound system for musicians. As for those snow piles that Butler's been chipping away at,
it's certainly not going away easily. It's like our winter here. There's a good one. It's certainly going to take its time in leaving, but there will be summer and there will be a market.
The National Weather Service says he could be shoveling more snow out of the lot Saturday morning. But it is technically springtime in Alaska, Butler says. And snow or not, the Spinard Farmers Market will open Saturday under the big white windmill sculpture. It runs 9 to 2 through the last Saturday in September. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Yakutat is gearing up for an influx of birders. They're coming to the northern southeast Alaska community to celebrate the return of a somewhat rare seabird. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
There's still a lot to learn about the Aleutian tern, but what Yakutat residents do know is that the seabirds return every spring.
We have one of the southernmost known and one of the largest known breeding colonies of Aleutian terns.
Susan Ohlers is a Forest Service biologist and one of the Yakutat Tern Festival's organizers.
So we decided we wanted to have a birding festival highlighting the Aleutian terns as well as the other natural and cultural resources here in Yakutat.
The Tern Festival began about 2 years ago. The idea was to bring more people to Yakutat between the spring steelhead season and the early summer salmon run. This year's event runs May 30th to June 2nd. It attracts birdwatchers from around the state in the lower 48, but Ohlers says it's not all about birds.
It's a very family-friendly festival. It's for birders and non-birders, so we have field trips that's looking at birds, but also just all of the great scenery we have here, like the Hubbard Glacier and Russell Fjord and getting out into the bay. So looking at birds, but, you know, just also kind of sightseeing and hiking.
Bird banding and calling sessions are among the events planned for teenagers and younger kids. The festival has a focus on Alaska Native culture and will include performances by Yakutat's Mount St. Elias dancers. Clinkett carver Doug Chilton is the festival's featured artist. Authors and language experts Richard and Nora Marks-Downhauer are the keynote speakers. Festival field trips will take birders to the Aleutian Terns breeding grounds, but they won't get too close.
They are sensitive to disturbance, so we keep a distance from where they're nesting, but you know, you can still get a pretty close-up view of them and, you know, possibly even be able to see one on a nest.
The festival's trademark bird is one of three types of terns living in Alaska. The Aleutian tern also lives in eastern Siberia. Researchers are studying Yakutat's colony to learn more about population trends, nesting, and migration patterns. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska is celebrating 100 years of aviation this year, and aviator Stu Ramstad is an important part of that history. He grew up in a gold mining family and became a pilot at age 14 in 1954. He says he didn't goof off in the air. He considered the plane a tool that you loaded up and used to deliver supplies. But he told APRN's Lori Townsend he did have scary times as a pilot and survived two in-flight fires.
One was in 1962. I was 22 years old. And I had planned to build a hunting and fishing lodge. And I was ferrying gas. It was in the wintertime. It was just before Christmas. And this airplane caught fire. It had a short in the battery in the back end. And that battery actually melted. It was they found drops of lead on the ice where I landed. It burned the hood off my parka, and I had on a pair of canvas mukluks that had leather soles, and the flames were coming underneath the seat, coming up over the top, and I had 85 gallons of gas in the back, and I was up real high because it was a windy day. When I landed, I threw my shotgun out, and it was getting so hot, I just jumped out and on the ice. As soon as the skis touched, I was gone, and it kind of knocked me out a little bit. When I woke up, I looked around, and the airplane was burning. Big black smoke going up. And I thought, oh, I got to get my emergency gear out of there. Of course, my snowshoes were gone. I couldn't. Anyway, I started running down the ice toward the airplane. And I kept hearing this pop, bang, you know, and all this snapping. And I thought, what in the dickens? And about that time, this piece of shrapnel come spinning across the ice. I looked, and I had a box of .243 Winchester ammunition that had been in the pouch in the back of the seat. Of course, that had melted off and gone into the fire. And those things were going off. And I saw that. I said, you know, you made it this far. It should be crazy if they found you dead as a wedge with a big piece of shrapnel between your eyes. And I turned around and I just ran and I let the thing burn. It burned about a 2-foot hole in the ice. The wings melted off, and I found out I didn't have any mukluks. All I had was the canvas on the top, and as soon as that leather got flames, it shrunk and it got hard, and it just cracked and broke apart, and it burned some of the fabric off of my the hood of my parka. I had a down parka, an Eddie Bauer parka, and so I had a hunting knife, and I had some matches that I had in the big pockets in my parka. And about 5 days later, my friend Jack Culhane, they used to own the garbage company here in town, he found me.
So you were there for 5 days. Where were you?
I set up underneath a tree, and I had a hunting knife, and I'd cut branches off and keep a little fire going all the time. And there was gas cans in the airplane that, of course, they were empty. They had solder, and they all came apart. And I took these gas cans, and I cut, made a set of mukluk bottoms. And I used the antenna wire that was strung out between the tail and the wingtips. And I dug around under the trees, and I got grass and dried it out at the fire and made myself a set of mukluks so I wouldn't freeze my feet. There was an old cabin there, but there really wasn't much. It had collapsed maybe 20 years before. And so when the roof went down, there was just a little wedge you could see in, and there wasn't any shelter or anything, but there were some old newspapers in there and some old magazines. And so I reached in there and I chipped those out of the frozen dirt and ice, and then I dried all the pages and watered them up and stuffed them down inside of my shirt and inside of my pants for insulation and that. There was some wind-blown places I could go get some berries, and I chewed on caribou moss, the white stuff, you know.
Stu Ramstead is a pilot. He still flies at age 73. Ramstead will be one of the pilots featured at a gathering at the Alaska Aviation Museum in Anchorage tonight. Pilots will tell stories to compete to be the boldest pilot in Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership in business industries across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well-rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.